Hey there, and thanks for venturing beyond the Rotunda, your Farmingdale Public Library podcast, where we often talk about literature, history, and community. But sometimes we answer questions like, who is your favorite fictional crime-solving character? I am your narrator, Kevin Schultz. Let's become aware. This is episode 16 of the Beyond the Rotunda podcast, a production of the Farmingdale Public Library, where we are more than just books. And I thank you for joining me this month. I do hope your Halloween was filled with all your favorite treats. As we welcome in November, I do have one more treat for you. My guest, Nassau County Police Officer Todd Atkin. We had a compelling conversation on situational awareness, what you can do to try and prevent an emergency situation, what you can do to try and survive an emergency situation. It is essential listening, so stick around for that. But first, let's check out our cover question. Who was your favorite fictional crime-solving character? There are so many options to choose from for this answer. Police officers, FBI or CIA agents, private investigators, mystery writers or spiritual leaders who became detectives. From books to movies to TV shows, the list is endless. Ultimately, I decided to go way back to my youth with the one that started my interest in crime mystery stories, Encyclopedia Brown. This series of 29 children's books written by Donald J. Sobel were the first books I ever checked out from a library. Back when I was six, I couldn't read them fast enough. The library couldn't get the next installment fast enough. The books follow kid detective Leroy Brown, nicknamed Encyclopedia, for his vast knowledge, as he and his friends solve one mystery after another. The series ran from 1963 all the way to 2012, which means there are about 25 years of books that I've never read. That might be half the series. I am thinking of binge reading the series and finishing it off. So Encyclopedia Brown is who is in my book. Let's find out who is in yours. Let's start with Jennifer from Farmingdale. My favorite is Joe Leaphorn from the Tony Hillerman books. There's also a TV series based on the books called Dark Wind. Jennifer, thanks for the suggestion. I have not yet read these books or seen the show. Now we have Georgine from Massachusetts, who says, my all-time favorite would be the queen of crime solving, Angela Lansbury's Jessica Fletcher from Murder, She Wrote. Georgine, I cannot agree more. My mom was a huge fan, and we would watch that show every Sunday after football. Now we have Anthony from Farmingdale, who says, Inspector Clouseau. The Pink Panther films were some of my all-time favorites. Anthony, hard to argue, Peter Sellers was a master of physical comedy. Dave from Texas writes, Sergeant Joe Friday. I grew up watching Dragnet. Dave, that's a classic. Liz from Farmingdale says, I will go with the psychic detective duo of Sean and Gus from the show Psych. Liz, love that show. Their banter cracks me up. Now we have a duo of our own, Jack and Shannon from Plainview, who say, Joe Swanson, the police officer from Family Guy. I laugh every time he's on the screen. So Jack and Shannon, I am not a huge Family Guy guy, but I am familiar with this character. Patrick Warburton, who does the voice, is a great comedic actor. Now we have Olivia from Queens, who says, Olivia Benson and Elliot Stabler from SVU. Love that show. Now, Olivia, I have to admit, I've never watched the show myself. Maybe I should give it a try. Our very own Natalie from the Farmingdale Library says, Lenny Briscoe from Law and Order, the king of the crime scene one-liner. Natalie, he is my favorite Law and Order character as well. Next, we have Christine from Florida and Samantha from New Jersey who agree. James Patterson's Alex Cross. Christine and Samantha, that's a good one. I have read several of these books. We've got Anthony from Brooklyn who writes, how about Frank Drebin from the Naked Gun movies? Hysterical. Anthony, good call, great movies. Dolores from Farmingdale says, Vera Stanhope from the series of books by Ann Cleves. It was also adapted into a TV series called Vera. Dolores, I am once again not familiar with either the books or the show, so I'm gonna have to check these out. We've got Laura from Plainview who says, Agatha Christie's Miss Marple, how she finds a clue out of the most simple things impresses me. Laura, you know, Miss Marple has always been on my TBR list, but I have never actually read any of those books. I've got to get on that. Now we have Chris from Queens and Joe from Florida who agree. Agatha Christie's Hercule Poirot, with Murder on the Orient Express being both their favorite case. Chris and Joe, he had to be on this list. And Agatha Christie is being very well represented. Finally, Chuck from Florida writes, I believe any and all crime solvers defer to the original master, Arthur Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes. Chuck, I can't argue with this. Our 1 year anniversary was a response bonanza. This question received the most responses to date, and I thank you all for that, and from all around the country. Let's keep that momentum going into next month's cover question. What is your favorite poem? Email me at beyondtherotunda@farmingdalelibrary.org or catch me on Instagram and Facebook. Now let's turn the page to my interview with Nassau County Police Officer Todd Atkin about the importance of situational awareness. We are here with Todd Atkin, volunteer EMT, Nassau County Police Officer, and a member of Nassau County Homeland Security. Todd Atkin, thank you for venturing beyond the rotunda.
Thank you for having me.
So now, before we get into your career and a very important conversation on situational awareness, let's ease into things with our cover question. Who is your favorite fictional law enforcement characters?
The first one I can think of is Maxwell Smart from Get Smart. I can remember being the younger kid in the neighborhood before I started kindergarten. I used to watch Get Smart every morning, and I even had a blank gun that looked like the gun that he carried. And I'd walk around the house with my bath up like I was Maxwell Smart. And my first crush was actually Agent 99, Barbara
course.
Felton, yeah. But more recently, my favorite is Jake Peralta from Brooklyn Nine-Nine. I think that is a hilarious show, and he's a detective in the NYPD. It's
Yes.
hilarious.
You guys, I've watched that show. It's a great show. What do you think Maxwell Smart's best gadget is?
Oh, of course, the original cell phone was a shoe phone. That was the best. He had that thing queued up all the
I agree.
time.
All right, so let's get into it. Where were you born and raised?
Huntington, Long Island, Suffolk County.
And you're still in the general area?
Yes.
Okay. And you volunteer as an EMT?
Yeah, I started that in 99, and second busiest in New York State. We cover a large area, and some of the greatest people I ever meet are the volunteers you'll see in facilities like this. You know, we see people at their worst, and such a caring group. We run six ambulances out of there, a mass casualty incident vehicle, and a few fly cars for our paramedics. And we self-dispatched when I started, so we took calls directly from the public, and we're now part of the priority dispatch for the last probably 20 years. And very rewarding. People people spend a lot of time. We get up in the middle of the night in all kinds of storms, grab our clothes, run in, grab an ambulance, and run out to someone's house. We all have full-time jobs outside of there. So very caring, very great organization.
That's amazing stuff. Can you share any stories of some of your calls?
It's funny. They say you always remember your first call. I remember my first call in an ambulance was a 17-year-old male sitting on his steps, difficulty breathing. And we took care of that pretty easily. We had some very memorable calls as well. September 11th, certainly, I left work and ran in, and we were all taking people off the train. Huntington is where the train line terminates before you switch over to go to the Port Jeff branch. And we were taking people covered in soot with broken bones and injuries off the train. We were supposed to go into the city for an 8-hour tour, and we ended up being there for 28-hour tours. And we were not at Shea Stadium. We were at Chelsea Piers right there. So, and we did a few shifts. We went in that night, shortly after midnight. Yeah, it was pretty intense.
Well, thank you for doing that. And so you're also a Nassau County police officer.
Yeah, I'm coming up on 20 years. Greatest job I ever had. It's my third career, basically.
What were you doing prior?
So I originally was a pre-med biology degree, was going to be an optometrist. I became a licensed optician a long time ago. I'm not telling many years, long, long time ago. I still practice every now and then. I continue my credits. And then I got into being a general manager and then ultimately a regional manager in Manhattan. The majority of my job was human resources at that point. So I went to St. Joe's, got my postgraduate certification, human resources. And then I was a director of human resources for a number of years. Good job, good benefits. I'm not the guy to sit behind a desk. And when you're working 75, 80 hours a week, it's a lot to sit behind a desk. And I was at the ambulance squad with my friend who I went to EMT class with, and we got motorcycles together, and we did a lot of fun stuff together. And he said, "Hey, let's go take the police test." And I'm thinking, police test? I have a house, I'm married, I'm starting a family, I have a career. And I was a little bit older, but I said fine. So I took Nassau and Suffolk police tests. I got called for Nassau. I was about halfway through the academy when Suffolk called, and I had to make a choice. And I stuck with Nassau because of the community-minded policing, which is amazing. We truly respond to everything in Nassau. Someone has a flat tire, I pull over, I've changed it. Before I was a police officer, we're encouraged to do that now as police officers. If somebody has a situation, like we had one case in particular, we had a woman in her late 80s who was doing spring cleaning, and she had her doors propped open and she had her windows open, and a crow flew into her house and she called the police. Most agencies would say call an exterminator and that's it, but they dispatch us, and my partner and I went in. And the longer that goes by since I tell the story, the bigger the bird gets.
Of course.
But it was a pterodactyl flying around our house. And my partner was able to, with a towel, grab him and bring him outside. That's the kind of stuff we do. That's the extras. I had another elderly gentleman on a Sunday, had a flood in his basement, was panicking. It was going to short out his electricity. So I went down, I turned off the water main. And then he had a phone book, the old-fashioned yellow pages. So we opened up for the emergency plumbers. I told him to pick one out. I waited till the plumber got there, and off I went. So these are the things that are, we do so much with the community, and it's ingrained in us in the academy. So for me, that was a good fit. So I picked Nassau for that reason.
That's great.
Yeah.
And how vigorous was your police training?
So it's about 7 months in the academy. It's a lot of law classes, civil rights classes, a lot of physical tactics, defensive tactics. Handcuffing, retaining your weapon, and then you go out and you do the emergency vehicle operations course, which is pretty intense, driving police cars, ambulances, taking them to their limits, seeing how far you can go and still control the vehicle. You need to know what your capabilities are before you hit the road. You go to the firing range, the rifle range, the gun range. You're there daytime and nighttime shooting for a couple of weeks, doing all kinds of drills. You literally have muscle memory developed to the point where, with your eyes closed and headphones on and all set out, there's a stimulus, you're able to react very quickly. It's pretty amazing. The ending part of that is you do role play, where you'll be in scenarios, and then you go into what's called simunitions, where it's actually the best training you can get. You will go out into these role play scenarios and you're carrying a real gun with all your equipment, but it shoots crayon tipped bullets.
Okay.
And there'll be scenarios, and based on how you do, it'll unfold one way or the other, and you have to get through it. And if you get shot with one of those crayon tip bullets, it leaves a welt for like 6 or 7 months. Yeah,
Wow.
I had one guy had a cracked rib, another guy got it in a knuckle, a fracture there. It's great, it's good training. And I'll never forget when I graduated, I had gone to my mom's and dad's for lunch one Sunday. And we're sitting, my mom said, "I'll be right back. I want to show you something." And she went to her room and she pulled out from first grade. I had an assignment with, we used to call it oak tag paper. And the teacher wrote on the top of everyone's paper, "When I grow up, I want to be." And I drew a picture of a police officer. So she's like, "Wow,
Wow.
you've always wanted to be a police officer. You just don't remember." And I had no recollection that I did this
Sure.
picture. And here I am, greatest job I've ever had. Truly
It was
amazing.
meant to be.
It is. I know my goal, my motto has always been make the world a better place every day. And to be able to do this at such a big level in Nassau with the police department, that the same philosophies as me, it's truly a fit made perfectly for me.
Now, in your training, do you excel in any one area?
I guess being in the human resources department and being an optician and dealing with people for all those years. It all comes down to communication. Communication is key. And whenever we're all evaluators in Homeland, we do these mass casual incidents or active shooter scenarios, and we evaluate the process. It always comes down to communication.
Right.
Clear, concise communication is always the key to whether something is successful or unsuccessful. And being a police officer, everything we do is about communication. And I was in the busiest precinct, third precinct, for approximately 13 years. I was on patrol for about 11 and a half of it. And the rest I was in the problem-oriented policing, which is community policing. Being in the busiest precinct, we do make a lot of arrests. And in my entire career, I've only had to go hands-on to cuff somebody up once. Everybody else I was able to
Wow.
talk into cuffs. And we don't want to go hands-on because there's no winner there. But the one case which I had to put my hands on someone to get them into handcuffs was a pretty bad car accident where the driver was under the influence of some drug and also drunk alcohol. And when we pulled him out of the car, he was unconscious. He jumped out of the stretcher and started running towards the parkway where there was some traffic forming early in
Wow.
the morning. And I was trying to get him away from the traffic. And then he started running and wrestling around. So we had to put him in cuffs to put him back into the ambulance to take him to the hospital. So that was the one time. But having the ability to communicate is key. And I have that from being an optician, dealing with the public, and also the human resource piece.
Yeah, one time is a pretty good ratio.
Yeah,
Yeah.
it really is. It really is.
What's the most dangerous situation you found yourself in on the job?
You know, one of the most dangerous things we can do is go to any domestic disturbance. One in particular, we got a 911 hang up and at a house where they called 911 hung up, and I knocked on a door. And I knocked on a door for about 10 minutes, and there was no one answering the door. And there was something that just didn't feel right. My spidey senses were tingling. And I kept walking around the house and knocking on both doors. And then finally, I saw the curtain move upstairs. I knew somebody was in there. And after 25 minutes of knocking, I told my supervisor, "I'm going to take the door and go in because there's somebody in there." So finally, as I screamed, "I'm taking the door," somebody opened the door. We walked in. I'm interviewing this young lady, and she's like, "There's no one else here but me." I said, "Well, you called 911. What happened?" "Well, my boyfriend's here, but he left." I said, "Why wouldn't you open the door?" I just felt like something wasn't right. So we're walking around, and there's nobody there but her. And then I see the pull down for the attic stairs. I
Right.
told my partner to cover the staircase. I'm going up. I go upstairs and I'm looking at this unfinished attic, which is kind of like 4 feet down the middle and it sloped down pretty big.
Right.
But the weird thing was the chimney went right through the center of the house, through the attic, and out to the roof. I'm walking up my flashlight and I felt somebody in the room. I could almost hear them breathing. And as I come around the chimney, this guy jumps out at me. And I immediately grabbed for my gun. I didn't take it out. I just put my hand on it and I gave him command presence and had him get on the ground. I pat him down for weapons and helped him down the stairs. And that was kind of frightening. But
Sure.
probably the most dangerous thing I ha happened to me was I was on patrol for just maybe 6 weeks. It was a beautiful day. I was taking a larceny report because people were breaking into cars in the shopping center.
Right.
They were stealing whatever they found. Back then, digital cameras were a big thing. They were stealing them. And I heard this loud shrieking, screaming sound coming from the other side of the parking lot. I excused myself. I went running over and I see a crowd of people along the back of a store. And one guy has another guy in a headlock with a gun to his head.
Wow.
And I immediately withdrew my weapon. And I kind of protected myself behind an engine block and I screamed out, "Police don't move." And as that person with the gun turned around to see me, the muzzle of his gun started to point at me. And I instinctively moved my finger from outside the trigger guard to the trigger. We never put our hand on the trigger until we're ready to use it.
Right.
I didn't even realize I did it. Muscle memory is amazing. And I was able to get him to drop his weapon, step back. They both were proned out. I went over, I safeguarded his firearm and handcuffed him. And it was a disturbance over something silly, but at the end of the day, nobody got hurt. And
Yeah.
that's always our goal.
That's an amazing story.
Yeah, it was pretty funny. It felt like 20 minutes before my backup arrived. Meanwhile, when I went back with the call, they were there in like a minute and a half. I already had everybody cuffed up, but it seemed like it was 20 minutes, you know,
Right,
and it was
right.
a minute and a half. Pretty
And
amazing.
what's going through your mind at that point? You're just reacting.
Just reacted. Muscle memory takes over. It's
Yeah.
like a surgeon doesn't sit there and wonder what they're going to do in the emergency room when a trauma case comes in. That's why they call it practicing medicine. They're always crafting,
Right.
practicing their craft, always getting better, and they just do what needs to be done and then they debrief afterwards. And that's kind of what we do. We have to be able to go in and do what we're trained, become a robot, and then we're able to fix it after. So probably my most rewarding call ever was a stillborn baby where we responded, and we get to this house. This woman is there in her bathroom. There's blood everywhere. It was like the scene from Scarface, you know. And
Right.
you know, you have to get past it and address what's going on in front of you. And I went over the radio to Fort Worth for the ambulance and more units to shut down roads so we could do a police escort to the hospital. We actually had to cut the cord. Wrapped the baby up because it's probably cold and baby was still warm. We did CPR immediately, transported mom and the baby in two separate ambulances. We did CPR all the way to the hospital. And when we pulled into the parking lot, the baby started crying.
Wow.
So, yeah, that was, and afterwards, you know, we didn't think much of it. We went on, took care of what we had to do, and then we left. We had another call, and then we came back to the hospital with the next patient. And this is at a big emergency room where nobody cares. Everybody's been there, done that. Everyone's calloused. You know, it's one of the busiest ERs in Long Island anywhere. And we had a round of applause.
Oh,
And
wow.
I had no idea who they were clapping for. There was doctors and nurses. And I looked at my partner who was with me. And we just looked like, who walked in? So we
Right.
put the patient care in. And we're transferring the patient to the hospital. I'm like, you know, they're clapping for you guys. We're like, what? So you have that possible breakdown afterwards
Yeah.
where you're just like, wow, what just happened? And the doctor said to us, I'll never forget it. He said, you guys didn't save a life. You gave that kid his life
Yeah.
because he was just born. And it was pretty amazing. And the
Yeah.
kid, I saw him not that long ago. This is probably about 13 years ago. He's bigger than me, healthy as an ox, football player, the whole nine yards. It's pretty amazing.
That's an amazing story.
Yeah.
So gratifying.
I've been blessed with a great career,
Yeah.
truly.
All right. So explain to us what NASA Homeland Security is.
So it's Homeland Security stood up after 9/11, and the county level of Homeland has nothing to do with the feds or the state level. We're part of emergency preparedness. We work with the Office of Emergency Management. And right now, what's going on is we have this storm in the state of emergency for this nor'easter. So we mobilized our Emergency Operations Command Center, or EOC. And we have all of our resources in a big room. And right now, we're handling how many calls do we have? How many trees down? How many wires down? Who has no power? What
Right.
is mass transit doing? What are the delays? So we kind of manage all that. And then we have everybody in the room, and we can deploy generators, heaters, fans, emergency food, emergency water rations. We handle a lot of that stuff. So that's going on this weekend. I just spent 19 hours in the Emergency Operations Command Center. That's one part of it. We do drone patrol for the big events. We do the nuclear radiological detections for the big events. We do school threats, school safety. We're very tied in with our houses of worship as well. And we handle and mitigate threats. We do follow-ups with threats. We handle security for all the big events. In the wake of COVID, we did, I think it was 49 food drives with Island Harvest with Randy, and we set up the whole parking lots with all the traffic flow, the pedestrian flow. We ran security. We do things like that. We bring in respirators, gloves, masks, bleach wipes to all the essentials, doctors, nurses, hospitals, essential food places. We take that role on. But we have a lot of big events in Nassau County. We just finished having the Ryder Cup, which is a worldwide tremendous event. We've had the PGA a couple times at Bethpage Black. We had the Cricket Championship. We had three presidential debates, which is amazing. No one's ever hosted three at Hofstra.
Mm-hmm.
We have the air show. We do major stuff. We had the VMAs twice over at UBS Arena. I got to be on the red carpet for a couple of those two. That was pretty impressive. But the reason why we have all of this is our police commissioner is very forward thinking. He's rewriting the way police work is done. Historically, something happens, you call the police. It's reactionary. He's very proactive. So by bringing in all these specialty units and by standing up this police unit in Homeland that does school safety coordination, this doesn't really exist. We have neighboring departments that have come in to observe us and ride with us. From as far as Florida, they've come to our meetings. We meet every single day, every Tuesday, and we go over every single school call that happens in every single school every single week. And we look for any threats and mitigate those threats and do follow-ups. And the reason why these kids are making threats in most cases, they're in crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the parents are in denial or just don't know or don't know what to do. And when we get involved, we're able to bring our partners in for mobile crisis. We're able to work with the school social workers and the school psychologists. We're able to get them resources they need to get them back to where they need to be. And in many cases, we have a lot of success stories where kids go from one place to another and now they're in a good position. They finish high school, they go to college, they have relationships, they have jobs. And everything's great. But if you don't see something and say something or know something and do something, we can't do that. And having Commissioner Ryder put this in, we've become the bench standard in New York State and as well as most of the country because they're starting to institute the things we do, the weekly meetings, the school safety coordinators. We do lockdown drills. We do this, the building level safety plans. We do the district-wide safety plans. We do situational awareness training where we go into the schools and tell them what to look for and what to do when they see it and how they can keep themselves safe and how to keep the school safe. We do security surveys in our houses of worship, our government buildings, and our schools, seeing what they're doing well, what they could do better. And sometimes there's grant money to help offset the cost. So by him doing all of these things, he's been able to give us a very prestigious title. U.S. World News Report has ranked us now 4 years in a row as the safest large city in America. You don't get that all these years in a row just by luck. The guy is rewriting the way law enforcement's done, and he's able to predict crime patterns and when they're going to hit and where they're going to hit and the types of crimes that are going to happen. And we're able to put people in positions, plainclothes units and all these different units that we have, our new SRT unit, they're able to go in and mitigate these crimes or catch them in the process before anyone else gets hurt. And we're able to keep the safety for the county and for the residents. This is what our biggest job is, the safety of our residents here in Nassau.
That's amazing. Wonderful program.
Yeah, excellent.
How many school threats do you get in a week?
That's a great question. So in Nassau County, there's 56 school districts, 450 public schools, and about 109 private schools, not to mention the colleges, right? So we're all assigned a certain amount of districts, and all of our districts, our principals, our superintendents, we are on a first-name basis, cell phone basis. I get calls 24/7, and I answer those calls. And I take those threats, and if I'm in the area, I'm running out there. Mm-hmm. If I'm on vacation, one time we were in Disney World, I surprised my wife and my son, and we were at Magic Kingdom waiting for the fireworks one night on a Sunday, and my work phone rang, and it was a superintendent, and somebody made an online threat. And I said, I'll be right back. And I walked away and I had this conversation. And I come back and the fireworks are over. Everyone's gone. My wife's sitting on the bench. My son is sleeping on her lap. She's like, can we go home now? So, these things happen, but it varies wildly. I can tell you that our last full school year, we had 1,575 school calls just in Nassau County in 1 year, just in schools. Now, they're not all threats. I mean, it's a mix of anything. But if you go back 5 years before that, we were doing 579 calls. So our call volume has tripled over a 5 year period. And our school threats for 23, 24, we had 103 school threats in a short amount of time. So it varies wildly. We find an uptick in school threats in the week preceding a school break. So February break, December break, before those breaks, everybody gets stir crazy, they get intense, and those school threats will go up quite a bit. So we'll have, early weeks in the school year where our school threat report is 3 pages worth of school reports of threats. And now we'll fast forward to a week that's busy. We'll have go from 3 pages to 22 pages of just listing all the school calls. So it gets to be a lot. And if there's any guns mentioned or shown in a picture or whatever it is, we'll get a consent search to search the home and make sure that the guns are secured or they're removed, if they have guns. And one of the things that's available to all schools and doctors and psychologists and police and family members is the red flag law, otherwise known as an extreme risk protection order, where if somebody is in crisis and they have firearms, you could petition a judge who will, in short time, rule yes or no, and then we safeguard those guns and hold on to them for them until they're at a crisis, and at some point they're able to show and demonstrate that they're no longer in crisis, they can have their guns back. It's just an extra safety net tool that we have that we can help mitigate any threats.
Amazing. So that leads us into situational awareness. So what is it and why is it so important?
So situational awareness is being aware of your surroundings, right? People, average people all over the world are faced with threats every day. It could be someone trying to mug somebody or carjack somebody, or it could be a bigger threat where someone's doing something nefarious where they're acquiring supplies or, scoping out a place or videotaping a place, getting ready for an attack, building a bomb or a massive shooting. And you don't have to look far. In the news, it seems like every week there's two, three, four of them that happen every week. And when I do my presentations for situational awareness, I explain I could come back next week and have a whole bunch of new slides. These things are happening, and someone is planning it while we're sitting here doing this podcast. There's people in their basement planning the next shooting, the next bombing. So by knowing what the signs are, we can help prevent this from happening. There's things called the pathways to violence, and they go through these steps, 6 steps that start with a grievance and ends with an attack. And if we intervene in any one of these steps, that attack doesn't have to happen. And in every one of these school shootings, there's always clues, right? We call it leakage. There's always information that people can find out about. And if they say something, these don't have to happen. So having a grievance in itself is not a problem, because driving here today, I had like 5 grievances of why people were driving today in this bad weather and speeding through. But there's these things called echo chambers. And social media has these algorithms where they try to match people up with similar likes. Well, it also works for people who have similar dislikes. So if I don't like ABC and the algorithm picks up on that, they'll link me up with a whole group that hates ABC. And what happens is we echo each other's disdain for something or hatred, and it magnifies it, and we start one-upping it, and it normalizes the hatred, which is dangerous. Then they start giving each other ideas. You know what? There was a mass attack at this place. You know what? Everyone else is doing it. We should get involved and start doing it ourselves. And they see these previous attacks, and it kind of escalates their thinking. Then they get into the planning phase, and they start doing their research. They start getting in now to the preparation where they're walking around with their cameras, they're acquiring supplies. And they end up doing like a final walkthrough. Sometimes they deploy assets, like in Columbine. They put backpacks full of magazines loaded with weapons, little CO2 cricket bombs, and 20-pound propane tank bombs, and they plant them all over the place. And then they finally commit the attack. And in Columbine, it took them 2 years to go from their grievance to the attack. 2 years of Clues. They were online shooting bottles and cans in the woods, naming students and teachers they didn't like. They
Right.
were part of that group. They called themselves the Trench Coat Mafia. And right now, there's hundreds of websites that play homage to these two lunatics that did this shooting. I don't mention the names of the shooters. I don't
Right.
think their names should be mentioned, but these two guys that did this, there's all these people Monday morning quarterback and say if they could have done this, that they could have had more kills, if they could have done that. And it's very frightening. And one of the steps, that fourth step, they go on social media in most cases and warn people, don't go here at 2 o'clock tomorrow. It's going to be a bloodbath.
Right.
And people see it and say, oh, this guy is crazy. But it's not, it's part of that plan. So those are the things that we talk about. And situational awareness is everybody should be aware of their surroundings. Did you ever see a police officer go out to eat? Where do they sit? Back to the wall, facing the door and the window. I mean, I've always done that.
Right.
But, you know, one of the nice things about Nassau County Police is the schedule. We do 12-hour tours. They're long days, but you work less days. So it gave me time off as a dad of a younger child. I was class dad. I was field trips, you know,
Right.
chaperone. I would do mystery reader. And, you know, we would bring the ambulance up for touch a truck. It was great. I'd do stranger danger talks. But when I go shopping with my son, go to supermarket, I would say, hey, where's your closest exit? Where's your second closest exit? Where would you hide if there's a problem? We'd go to the Islander game. Where's your closest exit? Where's your second closest exit? Where would you hide if there's a problem? We'd go to the movies. He'd say, Dad, you're crazy. There's an exit. There's an exit. I'd hide right there. So it's 21 days to form a habit. He has it. And now you fast forward. Now he's in college. He's at this point, a year and a half ago, he's 17. We're walking through, I don't know, 789 colleges till he picked one. But when he picked this, every building that we went into, whether it was a dorm, a lecture hall, a library, the gym, he's looking, he's looking, he's looking, he moves on. He has no idea he's even doing it, but he's looking for his exit, his second closest exit, his third exit. He's looking for his hiding spot. He's looking for resources to help him. And if it takes 3 seconds, it's a lot. But he's got this habit so ingrained, he has no idea he's even doing it. You know, it doesn't have to run your life, but it could save your life if you take the time
Right.
to do that and you don't even know you're doing it at some points. So I
So
think that's key.
he's not aware of it, but he seems like he appreciates the training that you gave
Yeah, he
him.
does. He does. I was watching him in the colleges when he was doing this just to see, and I'm like, wow, he's still doing it. And, you know, we haven't discussed it since he was probably four and a half. And I mentioned to him, he goes, oh, you know, you're right. I don't even think I was doing it. I know I do it. I just don't realize it. So it's important to do, but it doesn't have to run your life. You don't have to be scared about it. You just have to do it and move on.
So you once mentioned, I think, two different books that are good for
Yeah.
reading.
Yeah. So one of them is called The Gift of Fear. And Galvin de Becker wrote this book, and it talks about listening to your inner voice, that little intuition in the back of your mind when it says something is not right, to pay attention and listen to it and do something about it. That book is a must read as far as I'm concerned. And the second book is Amanda Ripley did so much extensive research. It's called The Unthinkable, When the Unthinkable Happens and How to Survive. And she interviews people that survived massive fires, train derailments, mass shootings, mass attacks, bombings. And she found the common denominator on all these people that survived. It's not the biggest, the fastest, or the strongest. That all helps. But it's the mindset. It's the people that go through, and she's come up with these three different stages you go through in an emergency. It's human nature. We're all very social, very human creatures. So we all go through the same thing. But the person that goes from the first phase to the third phase is the one that survives. That's the common denominator. And that first phase is denial. Denial is something that causes more deaths in these situations than anything else. Denial has two ugly cousins. The first cousin is what's called the normalcy bias. So if you're, and I want to give you an example of a nightclub in Warwick, Rhode Island. There's a band called Great White, big hair band from the 80s playing at the Station nightclub. And there's about 560 people there. And I believe it was in February. And what happened was people walked in these double doors down a 20-foot wide, 25-foot long hallway. And in that area, there's a stage, there's pool tables, there's a walk-in refrigerator, there's offices, there's a kitchen, there's a couple of bars, a dance floor. Everybody came in those two double doors. They went up to the stage. The lights went out. The band started playing. These giant sparklers went off on stage. And halfway through the song, the ceiling catches fire. The backdrop catches fire. The carpeted stage catches fire. And people stood there in denial. And that normalcy bias said, this can't possibly be happening. This has got to be part of the act. This is that mindset where your brain's being a little bit lazy and it can't fathom that something out of the ordinary, out of your routine, is actually happening. That's the normalcy bias. The second ugly cousin of denial is social proofing. Like I said, we're all very social creatures, we're all the same. Social proofing is you're looking around and saying nobody else is running to the door. It must not be an emergency. You might even tell yourself there's got to be a volunteer firefighter in the crowd. They're not running to the door. I'm not running to the door. I'm not going to be the first idiot to run to the door and be a coward. So you sit there and you watch this place burn. You watch this stage burn, and you're in this denial phase for those three reasons. And then you get into deliberation. That's the second phase. Deliberation is this is getting really hot, and it's getting tough to breathe. I'm going to have to get on the floor like I was taught in elementary school to get under that smoke curtain. And then you start saying, this is real. I'm going to have to come up with a plan. What am I going to do? So you start deliberating, and that takes time. Now, as you're deliberating, your stress level is going up. As your stress level goes up, your brain's ability to problem solve and reason starts to deteriorate pretty rapidly. Now, what else is happening in your environment? As you're waiting, smoke is getting thicker and filling up and coming down lower. The exit signs are obscured. People are starting to panic. Things may be falling from the ceiling that are burning, right? So now your egress is now being diminished quite a bit. Once that first person goes to stage three, which is decisive moment where you actually take action, they're going to run to the exit. What do you think everyone else is going to do?
They're gonna follow.
Mass exodus, correct. You're going to have. So what happened in Station Nightclub, it was a mass exit right to those two double doors. Unfortunately, at some point, people got wedged in because they were all panicked trying to get out. And it became a bottle stopper. Now, you have two brains in your head. You have the human brain, which is amazing. You can do, your executive function lives in your prefrontal cortex. You could do multiple things at once and schedule your day, and on the way home, you can get 16 phone calls of things you have to do, dry cleaning, pick up a gift, get something for dinner, and you can get this all efficiently done on your way home because your executive function's doing this. The human brain can problem solve, use rationale, and logic, and it's not a problem. But you have another brain lurking within your brain called your lizard brain. This is the most primitive part of your brain. It's where your fight or flight response lives. And what happens with the lizard brain, it's the exact opposite of the human brain. It reads the situation and it reacts instantly. Things just happen. So your lizard brain says, there's a fire on stage. I have to get out of here. And all it knows is to go out the way it came in. It's reacting to the fire, and the only thing it knows is to go out the way it came in. The lizard brain reads and reacts, and there's no problem solving. So what happened was all these people started mass exiting and they got in that hallway, the 20 foot by 25 foot hallway, and there was a bottle stopper. People couldn't get out. 31 people died in that hallway
Oh no.
because the lizard brain said, get out. This is all we know. And he stayed there. There were 100 fatalities that day. The only thing more tragic than a death is a preventable death. And they all tried to get out those two doors. And the biggest tragedy was there was three more exits that were never used. So, by having my son look for his closest exit, his second closest exit, his hiding spots, the resources around him, you're pre-programming your lizard brain. And the lizard brain can save your life or it could cost you your life. And for those 100 people in the Station Nightclub, the lizard brain played a big role in them not surviving. And there were another 230 people injured. But at some point, somebody smashed some windows using their human brain. And a lot of people followed, but they may not have made it out. But if the other exits were used, you wouldn't have had the bottle stopper effect of the two doors possibly, and people were going out the other three. You may have been able to get everything together. So having the lizard brain pre-programmed, it'll very quickly guide you out. And by listening to that little voice in the back of your head, in the gift of fear, it's going to make you recognize that this is not normalcy bias. There is a problem. And by having Amanda Ripley's three stages of an emergency, you're going to go from denial to deliberation, the decisive moment quicker. You have a much exponentially better percentage chance of surviving something like that.
Wow. So essential reading.
100%.
So you mentioned the training you kind of give to you gave to your son. You also have told me in the past you have a neighbor who's a firefighter.
Yes. So my neighbor's a retired FDNY lieutenant, and he does fire drills in his house twice a year. So he's got a high ranch, lives with his wife, his three kids, and his mother-in-law.
Okay.
And they have that chain ladder that goes out the second story. He actually does these full drills when they change the clocks. He checks all the batteries on his smoke detectors, like you
Right.
should. But they go out wherever they are. He waits till everybody's where they normally are in the room. They're in the bedroom, they're in the kitchen, wherever they are. And he'll just call the fire drill. And he times it. You got to get out.
Okay.
So the kids climb out the window. They love it. Mother-in-law hates it. But they also have a meeting point. It's not just getting out of the house. They go across the street and two doors down. The Smiths have a wraparound porch with a rocking chair and a swing, and that's where they meet so they can reunify, which is very important because God forbid there's a fire at Bob's house and everybody jumps out a different window and he can't find little Johnny. Bob's going back into his burning house, and he's going to stay there until one of two things happen. A, he finds little Johnny. Or B, he doesn't find little Johnny, but he's not coming out. So he's going to stay in there until he dies trying to find little Johnny. And if he ran to his friend's house two doors down the other direction and he feels safe there because he's scared, he's playing Xbox with his friend, Bob's looking for his son. It's not in the house and he's not going to make it out that day. Again, preventable death. So by going through the muscle memory of getting out of your house and then reunifying at the Smith's wraparound porch, he can account that everyone's there. And if they're not, he knows they're in the house. And I'll give you another scenario. If he gets to the Smith's porch and his mother-in-law's not there, is he going back into his house for his mother-in-law? Yeah, he might not. Depends on what day it is, right? No, he's a great guy. And listen, I was in Vegas for a symposium recently, and I got upgraded to like the 34th floor of the Palazzo. I think it's 46 floors. And the first thing I do when I get in there is I check the back of the door. Because on the back of the door, it has a map of that floor and it tells you where your exits are. And if you're in the 34th floor of a 46 floor hotel or a building of any sort and there's a fire, well, the elevator is going to go to the ground floor and lock out in the open position. And if that hallway is filled with smoke and you're crawling around looking for the staircase, that's not the time to be looking for it. So I always make sure I tell everybody, check your staircases, check for the fire alarm pull stations, check for the fire extinguishers. You know, they all have signage, but you have to know where they are before you need them. And if you have somebody like my father-in-law who had his hip replaced and had a walker, if he's on a 34th floor and a fire breaks out, maybe I could carry him down two flights of stairs because I have an adrenaline rush. But after that, what's going to happen? Is the fire department's going to help get him out, but are they starting on the first floor and working their way up to the 34th floor? Are they starting on the 46th floor and working their way down to the 34th floor? It's a lot of time that you don't have in an emergency. So maybe you book your father-in-law on the first or second floor of the hotel, and I stay on the 34th floor. And then I can get out and he can get out and we can all be safe. Right, these are the things you should think ahead about. If there's anything that limits someone's mobility, maybe you want to be in a better situation to prevent this from happening.
Important lessons, yeah. So you also have an example that you want to talk about the Sandy Hook Promise videos?
So Sandy Hook was a horrific tragedy. We all remember the Sandy Hook tragedy, and it's one of these things that the organization is these parents and the students. Some of those students didn't make it. It's an amazing organization. And they have, I think they're up to 14 videos now that are so powerful. They're on, you know, you could probably go onto YouTube and find them all. And we show these videos when we do our situational awareness because they're so powerful. And there's a couple you show, there's not a dry eye in the room. And I'm dealing with teachers in the high school that have been doing this for a long time. And it hits home, and I have a problem getting through the videos because I get choked up. But one of the videos that I think that's very powerful is called tomorrow's shooting. And they're at an elementary school, and there's a woman with her young daughter, and the person is interviewing about tomorrow's shooting. And she said, you know, what's going to happen tomorrow when the shooting starts? Well, when the shooting starts happening, I'm going to think that's a car backfiring or fireworks, right? That's the normalcy bias. And then they're going to be in denial over the sounds of the shooting. And they're going to interview the teacher, and that something's been off with him since the beginning of the school year. He's been a little antisocial. They're going to interview the social worker. Yeah, he's been socially withdrawn, and he's, you know, had some searches online for maybe past school shootings or gun capacities. And they're going to interview some of the other students. Yeah, he's pretty weird, so we've been bullying him, and we're going to bully him continually because he's pretty weird. And they're going to talk to the police that are responding. It's, yeah, tomorrow when the shooting happens and we start intimate, they're going to say something's been going on with him. He's been acting strange. He's dressing differently. He looks differently. And, you know, at the end, they ask this mom, how are you going to explain it to your daughter? And she says, I won't get to explain it to my daughter because she won't make it. So there's like this close-up of this beautiful, like, three-year-old girl with the mother holding her. And it's just, it wakes you up a little bit. You know, it's so powerful.
Very
And
powerful.
the problem is, Columbine happened on April 20th, 1999. So on April 21st, 1999, they interviewed teachers, fellow classmates, whatever, co-workers, whoever they could find, neighbors, and they said what they said. And then if you take the shooting last week and you switch the interviews the next day, it's still the same stuff. It's everything in that video, tomorrow's shooting. It's everything in that Sandy Hook Promise video. It's the same people saying the same things. All the signs are there, but nobody said anything. And that's the problem. And it's these pathways to violence are these clues. And if we step into any one of these spots, it doesn't have to happen. And that's the message we get across.
And there's always time to do that.
And there's avenues. I mean, you can tell your human, if it's a coworker, your human resource manager, your manager, you could tell your guidance counselor as a school student, you could tell the principal, you could tell the social worker. There's hotline numbers, there's all these things. You can go on to any social media at NCPD and get into an anonymous reporting. And Sandy Hook has something called the Say Something app, which is their anonymous reporting line, where a student could actually go in and make an email, a phone call, or go through a texting system and get somebody that's not necessarily the school person, but their own internal Sandy Hook Promise person. And the Say Something app allows them to notify who needs to be notified without the kid feeling like he's going to get caught or get blamed for telling on somebody. But it's that student's own safety at stake, and all their friends there at the school and their teachers. So, you know, the word's getting out. It's a great program. There's a few different ways schools work on this, and it's part of their plan. But it's something that people, if they're aware of their surroundings and they pick up on these things and they get involved just by saying something, they're able to then prevent these things from happening. I sound like a broken record, but it's so important it bears repeating over and over again.
No, it's an important lesson. Can you talk about the Houston Police Department video?
Sure. So we have a situational awareness that we do for libraries. We have one for schools. We have one for doctors and nurses. We have one for the public, one for government buildings. And they're all kind of tailored specifically. The big one we do also is caretakers of the congregation for our houses of worship partners. And one of the things that we do is we include the video. The Houston Police Department is like the bench standard on how to prevent being a fatality in a active shooter situation. It's called Run, Hide, Fight. It's online. You can watch it for free. I think the big one is about 12 minutes. It shows like an office building situation. And the Run, Hide, Fight is about running and hiding until you can get out of the building you're in where the attacker is. And the last case scenario is the worst case scenario, where you have to fight. And you need to decide beforehand today that you're not going to be the victim, they're going to be the victim. If you're in the wrong place at the wrong time and someone starts shooting, you need to decide today that you're not going to be a victim. You're going to use your three stages of your Amanda Ripley's way of handling an emergency, right? Your denial, your deliberation, decisive moment, and you're going to use that little voice that Galvin the Beers was talking about, and you're going to get yourself out of that situation. And you could be in a store. Every store has a great weapon. It's a fire extinguisher. And if you don't remember fifth grade science and use a fire extinguisher, think about cooking in your kitchen and now the curtains go on fire. And wait, I have my extinguisher, but where is it? Okay, I know where it is. Do you know how to get it off the wall? Is it under the sink behind the bleach? And then you get the extinguisher out and then you stop to read the instructions. Your whole wall's engulfed in flames. Is that the best time to do it? And by the way, fires can spread very quickly. The Station nightclub was fully engulfed in 6 minutes. And if you're in denial for 2 minutes and then you're deliberating what to do for a couple of minutes and now you're trying to get out. So it's good to know before you need it. So I always say, you have a fire extinguisher. What's the mnemonic on how to use a fire extinguisher? It's pass. You pull the pin, you aim at the base of the fire, you squeeze the handle, and you sweep back and forth. It's not the time to read the instructions when your wall's on fire because you're not going to absorb it. So your lizard brain may start taking over and not even let you figure that out. But knowing how it works, it's very important. So if you're in a store and that attacker's coming and you find yourself in the changing room and there's nowhere to go, you can't run and hide anymore, grab that extinguisher, pull the pin, aim it where you think this person's face is going to be, and squeeze the handle to get that stuff into that person, attacker's face, hit him with that extinguisher and get out of there. And every store pretty much has fire extinguishers in there. And if you're paying attention to your emergency exits, they're usually not too far from there. They're usually by the bathrooms. They're usually by the changing rooms. If it's a restaurant, they usually have them near the kitchen too, as well as the dining room. And you start to realize there's a pattern where they put these. And as you walk into places, you can figure out where they are. And it makes an amazing self-defense weapon if you're in a situation like that.
Yeah, that's a great tip. Do you have any success stories you can share with us?
As far
As
as
far as helping kids in the beginning stages of their grievances?
oh, so yeah, we have, I guess, a great relationship with our schools, our houses of worship, our first responders. We share actionable information with this partnership we have. And we prepare by having the education and having the conversations. But when there's a situation in the school, I'll typically get a phone call before they even call 911 to run it past me. What are we going to do in this situation? And then we'll, let's say, call 911 and I'll go to the school and we'll go through all the steps and we'll find out what kind of history they have, what's been going on at home. Are they changing the way they appear, their looks? So we had one kid in particular who was putting these very scary videos on his social media posts. And he's mentioning the mastermind of Columbine, and he's mentioning Kurt Cobain, and he's holding a rifle in his hand, and he puts it to his head and pulls a trigger. It turned out to be a fake plastic gun, but he's mixing like an anti a decongestant with alcohol and psych meds, and he gets off the wall. He's actually wearing a shirt with a picture of the guy who was the mastermind of Columbine. But we kind of adopt him. Our detectives would go and visit him all the time. They'd have book time with him. They would relax with him. They'd wheel him in. The guy had a job. He went back for college. He started doing things that were meaningful to him and didn't have a reason to get back into these rants and mix these things together, right? And you find a girlfriend, a significant other, and you're able to, have meaningful stuff in your life. And we have a lot of success stories that we can do. We had a student that was honors all the way through one of the top school districts. Halfway through 12th grade, he kind of went off his meds and snapped and was saying crazy things at JFK Airport while he had his GoPro going. And he ended up getting banned from the school. But they said, we're going to make sure you graduate. You're going to do school from home in the last half of the school year and you'll graduate. And he put on social media how he was going to go to graduation. No one's going to stop him. He's trying to get support from the other students. So like our detective's like, yeah, we're going to take him out for lunch and a movie with his dad and him just so he doesn't go to graduation. We don't want to have to arrest somebody, especially at graduation, that's a 17-year-old or an 18-year-old. So we think out of the box. We try to think of ways we can prevent things before they get to that point. And that's what they do. The first grade detectives, we have mobile crisis, we have our intel unit, we have our homeland unit, and we work together. Probation is there, and we all come up with plans and follow-up timelines and who's going to the house. And we just want to monitor and continue. And I do follow-ups for my students with my social workers and my principals on a daily, weekly, monthly, or whatever. It depends on the severity of what the situation was.
That's great stuff. It sounds like just being present is important.
100%. Being involved is so important. And for me, it's one of these things where I started doing Stranger Danger and Pop with these kids in first grade and kindergarten. I'm doing bike safety in third grade and fourth grade. And then I'm doing touch a truck with the police cars when they're a little bit older. And then we'll do a back to school stuff. And then I'm out there, with the kids, and they all get to know me after a while. I'm doing mystery reader or parents as reading partners. I still do all that. I love it. Then I go back for career day when they're, and then sometimes I'm at graduation and I feel like my kids have graduated. And I'm getting old because I see these kids from kindergarten at graduation, but it's sad that they're leaving. I feel like my kid's going away to college every time I see these kids leave, but it's also so rewarding. It's amazing.
I can see it. Do you have any advice for someone like myself who's visually impaired or just disabled in general?
Well, I think one of the things is knowing your surroundings, and it depends on whatever it is, how you function through your day to day. Finding out where those exits are, knowing who's around you, knowing who you can rely on, being tuned into those sounds, that's tremendous. As an optician, I dealt with low vision patients for a long time, and I would get interesting questions. I have a question actually for everybody out there listening. Why is it some of the crosswalks have the tones and the sounds that are great for people that are visually impaired? And they're at busy intersections, but there's a lot of busy intersections that don't have that. Why is that not mandatory at every major intersection? I don't understand how
I
they
don't
don't
have
have
an
that.
answer.
It should be. I mean, the tones are so important. So dealing with patients for years with these different scenarios, it's important to be able to listen to those background sounds. Hearing something, and you can be listening and not hear something. And I'll tell you, my wife says I'm probably the world's greatest expert because when she's talking to me and I'm listening to her, I'm not always hearing her. So she probably has a few examples of that. But, there's things going on all around you. And by actually hearing that background sound, you hear something fall, you hear somebody screaming, you hear a chair fall over. Is somebody in trouble or is there a fight going on? Is somebody racking the slide of a gun? And, these are the sounds that you may understand what they are and you may be listening, but if you don't listen to them, it's like that little voice in The Gift of Fear. You gotta pay attention, and that'll give you more time to get through those three stages and get out. That's the key.
You once told me a story about your son and his headphones.
So I coached my son's ice hockey team for years, and I think it's a requirement that any kid that plays any sport has to have earbuds in to listen to music for practice and games. And it's not one little set of earbuds anymore. They're noise canceling, and these headphones, the earbuds, are so powerful at canceling. They're actively canceling the ambient sound around you. You don't hear anything but what's coming out of the earbuds, and it really shuts you down from your environment. So my son gets the right earbud that pairs with his phone on Bluetooth, and the left earbud stays at home. So every time he goes to practice or a game, he's got one earbud in. He can hear a car horn. He can hear screeching tires. He can hear someone screaming to watch out. And he's still present to his surroundings. He's still tied into that. And the other kids would make fun of him sometimes. And then after a few practices, the parents would say, "Hey, coach, why does your son have one earbud?" I'd explain it to him. And then a practice two goes by, a game goes by, and now all the kids have one earbud. And now my son was a fashion sense shredder and not a, the kids be laughed at. It makes total sense. And it's adults too. They're buried in their phones. They have their earbuds in. They have no idea what's going on around them. The peripheral vision is cut down because their heads are down and they have the sound blocked out. They're completely isolated from their environment. It is a very unsafe scenario. And these kids on their e-bikes and the scooters, even the adults and the skateboards that go 40 miles an hour, they have earbuds in and they're looking at their phones because they control the speed of the skateboards with their phones, or the one that bike's doing everything. They're not paying attention to the traffic around them. We've had a couple of fatalities this in the last 12 months with high school students on
That's
e-bikes.
sad.
It's very sad. It's tragic.
As a visually impaired person, when I am wearing my earphones, I always have one out
Smart.
because I need my hearing's important. I need my hearing.
100%.
I'm sitting here right now, which is one in my right ear and the other one's open.
I can verify that. That is true.
So we know each other a little bit. Your demeanor is very calm, very even keeled. Is that something you've had your whole life? Was that developed? And how does that assist you out in the field?
That's a great question. And again, communication is key. Part of the communication is body language and putting people at ease when you're in a situation. I've had my moments over the years growing up and dealing with things, but I think being with the ambulance squad and seeing some of the things I've seen from gunshot victims to the 9/11 patients, it kind of gives you context for things in life. And the small things that people blow out of proportion sometimes get themselves stressed out, blood pressure goes up. I think for me, those things are almost welcome, these mundane challenges, because it's normalcy for me. Being a police officer, I'm just about to hit 20 years. I was in the busiest precinct. I've been through a few things. You start to appreciate the little things in life, the problems in life, and getting to the point where you're excited and you're starting to function on less of your cylinders. You're not firing all cylinders at that point. Your lizard brain's starting to creep in. Your brain's deteriorating and it's problem solving, and it doesn't help anything. And being in a few emergency situations, and in fact, one of the things we did for the police academy I didn't mention was we go to the fire academy. And many people have never had a battle of fire with a fire extinguisher. And they make us battle a paper fire with a regular extinguisher, and then there's maybe electrical fire and using ABC fire extinguishers. And then you're fighting a grease fire and you can't use water, and there's all these different types of foams and things. And then they do something that's pretty scary. They lock you in a brick building with a giant pile of ignitables. They ignite this fire in this room, and then they close the steel door with a very loud thunk that echoes. And you're there watching this burn, and it's pitch black except for the fire burning, flickering. And it gets very big and very hot very quick. And you find yourself laying on the ground so you can breathe. And then it's all right, now you're going to have to crawl out. And you have to be able to get to that exit, and they're there to keep us safe, but you're not thinking about them. You're thinking about getting yourself out. And they start to get you to the brink of panic mode. Because once you've been there and done that, you develop the muscle memory, you start to realize, okay, I've been here, I've done this, I can handle this, I know how I got out of it, there's a way out. And that inner calm takes over through muscle memory, and you're able to navigate these situations. I did have one of the biggest guys in my academy class next to me who was a little bit claustrophobic, and when they slammed that door and let the fire, he was trying to get out. I had to use all of my human resource communication skills to keep him calm. I'm glad I was next to him, and I'm glad he didn't start swinging because he's a big, big guy. But when the fire lit and we had to get on the floor, he tried to jump up and run out, and I'm like, I pulled him down. I said, "We're going to crawl out of here right now. Follow me. I'm going to get you out." And we started to go. But that's early stages, and everybody's coming from a different place. Maybe I've seen more with the ambulance squad, and someone's been behind a desk or never had a real job. And for them, small things could be like, wow. And then for us, I've been through some bigger things. So small things are still small things. And the best analogy is the first time you're driving a car on a highway and you get a flat tire, it could be like the world's closing in on you. What do I do? And you panic. But if you change your tire, and this happens 3 years later, like, oh, flat tire, let me change it on call AAA. It's not a big deal because you've been there and done that. And that's kind of like what happens with us. So I think as you go through life in general, you've experienced more.
Experience, yeah.
You can be calmer about things that would have, when you were younger, would have set you off to a panic mode. And I think that's a big part of it.
Interesting. As we approach the holidays, does situational awareness become even that much more important?
It comes out. So unfortunately, there's things called soft targets, and malls are soft targets, right? It's not like it's a government building. Schools are highly fortified in these days. They used to be soft targets. Now they're always locked. They have security guards. You can't go in unless you have ID. You have to have an appointment. They've become fortified. But to go to a mall, when there's a lot of concerts around the holidays, there's a lot of people. They all have their guard down, and it's an attractive target. So by we go into the malls and we do situational awareness with all the tenants, the stores, the security there. We work with them. We have safety plans. They've come a long way. They really have. But it's just for somebody looking to do damage. These are places they look for. So situational awareness has to go up even more. And it could be as something as walking through the parking lot with a bag from a very expensive store or electronic store. that you're walking out with and people are watching you and you put that in your trunk, as soon as you go back into the mall to get more stuff, they're breaking into your car and stealing
Right.
it. Or they follow you to your next stop where you're going to meet your friend for lunch. While you're in the restaurant, they're breaking in. And that's another thing. People are spotters in banks and they're sitting inside watching who's taking out large sums of money, or they have binoculars in the parking lot and they work in teams. So they're watching, okay, this guy's wearing a blue shirt and yellow shorts. He's walking, he just got a wad of cash, an envelope, it's in his left front pocket. And he's getting into whatever, a green car, and he's heading eastbound on this road, and the other guy follows him and he's not paying attention. And if you make any stops along the way, people tend to take the money out of their pocket and hide it in the console for some reason, or the glove compartment or under the seat. They're watching. As soon as you go in, they smash your window and they take it. That's one of the big things that goes on now. It's been going on for a few years. So around the holidays, people are taking out more cash. People are mailing gift cards. People are spending money. They're bringing cash with them to the stores. They're bringing out stuff. People are watching and looking to steal those things. So being aware of your surroundings is just going to help you safeguard those things in itself.
That's some important stuff to learn.
It
It's a little terrifying.
seems to be a lot at times, but it's just something that's 21 days to form a habit. Like I said, let the habit happen and let it guide you as you go through.
Right. Situational awareness is a heavy subject to discuss, but very important.
Agreed.
I thank you for sharing your insights.
Of course.
But we're not done. We're gonna lighten the mood a little bit, and we're gonna play a game that I call Blind Man's Bluff.
Okay.
I'll give you three choices, two of which are true, one is a bluff. You got to figure out the bluff.
Okay.
All right, so you ready?
I think so.
Okay. The first category is literary detectives.
Okay.
We've got Nancy Drew, Jane Marple, or Tony Francis.
Jane Marple is the bluff.
No,
Oh, it's Tony
it's
Francis.
Tony Francis. You know
It's true. It's
that
true. I forgot
one.
that.
Jane Marple is otherwise known as Miss Marple from Agatha Christie. We
Yes.
all know Nancy
Of
Drew.
course. And the Hardy Boys.
Yep. And Tony Francis those are my middle names.
Okay.
We next category is TV detectives. We've got Lenny Briscoe, Maria Mastro, or Frank Colombo.
Maria Mastro.
Maria Mastro is the bluff.
Big fan of Jerry Orbach. I'll tell you, I went to see at Westbury Music Fair, 42nd Street. We ended up going with my family. And I was in the aisle seat. I'll never forget it. And then he started off on Broadway, which I didn't know,
Right.
Jerry Orbach. And then I look up, he was standing right next to me in the aisle getting ready for his cue to run on stage.
Cool.
I'm like, Jerry, you're awesome. And he pat me on the back and said, hey, thank you. Because I'm going to go sing a song now. And he ran down the aisle and jumped on stage. And he had a great voice.
Yes.
Great guy.
I was impressed he was in he was Lumiere in Beauty and the Beast, the animated show.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
He's doing a French accent and he's amazing.
That's great.
So our third category is movie detectives. And your choices are Marie Marquis, Benoit Blanc, or Jacques Clouseau.
Well, Jacques Cousteau was my was a, oh Jacques Cousteau was the youngest. Is that Peter Sellers in the Pink Panther? I love those. Those were great. And the first two is Maria
Maria Marquis
Marquis.
or Benoit Blanc.
Maria Marquis.
That is the bluff.
All right.
Benoit Blanc is the detective in, I think it's Daniel Craig, in the Knives Out
Knives
movies.
Out movie. Yeah,
Yes.
gotcha.
All right, good. Pretty good job.
Yeah, I got one wrong. All right. And I knew that one too. I don't know what I was thinking.
Yes.
Maria Marquis.
Well, Todd Atkins, I thank you for not only being here and talking about situational awareness, but for being out there and trying to keep our community safe.
Thank you for your support. Appreciate that.
And thank you for venturing beyond the rotunda.
Pleasure being here. Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you very much. I hope you enjoyed my interview with Todd Atkin and you were able to gather the value of situational awareness. Check out the videos he mentioned, Run, Hide, Fight from the Houston Police Department, and the Sandy Hook Promise videos. They all can be found on YouTube. As I said at the top of the show, become aware, make a plan, be prepared. It could save a life. I thank my guest, Todd Atkin. I thank Maxio for our theme music. Thanks to Natalie and Brendan. And of course, thanks to all of you for listening. I cannot express enough how much I do appreciate it. I hope you join me next month when my guest will be Catherine Hughes, author of In Silence Cries the Heart, an epic historical fiction book that takes place in 17th century Scotland. Give it a read and join me for the interview. Until then, take care and enjoy wandering the stacks.